Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. While residents in our region shelter at home, many of us are cooking like crazy. For some, it's a great excuse to get creative in the kitchen and try new ideas, from baking bread to mastering complicated new recipes. But for others, it's a struggle to find fresh ideas to feed the family. And what happens if you're clueless in the kitchen altogether? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. As the governor's safer at home order continues, more people are cooking and baking than ever before. It's presenting a unique challenge for individuals and families trying to avoid mealtime monotony. This week is the final piece of a four-part series dedicated to the COVID-19 outbreak and its effect on North Central Wisconsin. You can find past shows in our archive at wpr.org/route51. Earlier shows focused on the science, the community impact, and the emotional toll of the pandemic, but this week we turn our attention closer to home, the kitchen, to be exact. Joining us today from Stevens Point is Chef Christian Shawanka, better known as Chef C, to offer tips and tricks for cooking at home, jazzing up ordinary dishes, incorporating locally sourced ingredients, and involving the whole family in meal preparation. Chef C, welcome back to Route 51.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning.
You bet. So how about you? Is your kitchen routine in need of a boost? Are you looking for creative ways to use up leftovers or the staples you have in your cupboard? Or maybe you're trying to satisfy a hungry family tired of the same old recipes? Well, take heart. This show is for you, and Chef C has the answers. Your questions and ideas are welcome. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join the conversation by calling us. 800-780-9742. If you are calling, make sure you let the phone ring a long time for technical reasons. Chef C, you've been in the restaurant business for a long time, I know. How did you get started cooking? Was it something you always liked, even as a child, or what?
Yeah, definitely. My family is a bunch of cooks, basically, always in the kitchen making stuff. My grandmother, my mother. I was probably about 7 or 8 years old when I just got drawn into the kitchen. I'd always be helping my mom stir things, you know, chop things. I'd be washing dishes all the time. She put on a lot of dinner parties for like 8-10 people, and I would help and get those parties ready and that kind of thing. So just something about that. And then I was fortunate enough to get out of high school and go right into culinary school. I went to the Culinary Institute of America and did a 2-year program there. I got an associate's degree, and much like most people who go to culinary school, you think you're a chef when you come out, and it's exactly the opposite. You have to now go in and, put in your time, basically, and I've been doing this now for 30-something years.
So basically you were 2 when you started, right?
Yeah, basically, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, for me, it's it's the energy that food gives, it's that. It changes every day, every season. The temperature changes, the quality of the food is, constantly changing, and what's out there is changing. And it's just, for me, it's not your ordinary job. I've never felt like being a chef is a job. I've always been super passionate about what I do and sinking my teeth into every day and, making the best food I can make and kind of going with the flow and what's out there,
That's great. I always think that cooking is a bit like creative science because you're kind of following this recipe, these instructions on how to make this thing. But it's the creativity.
You mess up a lot.
your own flair that kind of adds to it. So I know some people are pros at this, but other people are learning to cook for the first time. My son, for example, he's living out in Salt Lake City, and he bought an instant pot. He's experimenting with recipes for the first time since he can't go anywhere. Yep. So for people like my son, or people like other people who aren't used to being in the kitchen, what are some of the basic building blocks of cooking that every new cook should learn?
Obviously being able to use a knife and hold a knife and, not cut yourself is probably the biggest thing to get yourself situated in the kitchen. You need a few basic knives. You don't need like a whole knife collection necessarily. You don't want to use a knife that's too big for the job or a knife that's too small for the job, So usually like an 8-inch, 10-inch chef knife is something good to have. Then it's kind of understanding, the ingredients that you're working with. If you're buying produce, you want to make sure you're buying fresh produce and you want to kind of be adventurous. You want to, not just do things that you've done before, but try new things, and new techniques. And it really is a trial and error kind of thing. You're going to, you have to figure out how to use the temperature on the stovetop in the oven. Is it gas? Is it electric? And all those things are so many factors involved in cooking.
Yeah, I think trial and error is what I'm hearing. It's
not being afraid. Yeah, not being afraid is probably a big thing, I would think. A lot of people are just, they're very hesitant to jump in there and do stuff. And, you have to kind of have just to go in there and go get it attitude. And if it's messed up, hey, you learn from everything that you mess up, which is awesome. So you're probably not going to do that again if you messed it up,
Yeah. Besides the knives, and I have to I actually cut myself yesterday while I was making lunch. be careful with those sharp knives. What kind of basic equipment should everyone have? Do you need all kinds of fancy stuff or, what do you need?
No, I mean, basic saucepans, basic pot pan, a pot that you can boil water in for making like pastas or a soup, a smaller pot for making sauces is nice. A couple saute pans, like a nice egg pan, like a 6-inch, 8-inch pan you can make your eggs in is nice. You can get a bigger pan for like pan frying. So you don't really, you don't need a ton of things. I like having I actually have a tortilla pan that sits on my stovetop at all times because I make a lot of quesadillas and things like that as good snacks on the fly, So I use that for toasting pitas and things like that. So you don't need a ton of things, but just the basic stuff, kind of build from there. You want a strainer to strain your pasta and your potatoes and things like that. It's nice to have like a couple ladles and some wooden spoons and some metal spoons and rubber spatulas, So there's definitely some good basic core things that you want to try to have in your kitchen because, measuring spoons, teaspoons and measuring cups. And, if you're doing baking and pastries, it's crucial that you measure those things out, which is why I'm not the best baker in the world because I'm pretty much kind of go as I go kind of chef and I don't measure a lot of things, so that always
eyeball
comes
it.
Back on me.
Yeah.
Yep,
yeah,
exactly.
Eyeball it.
What you can't do in baking and pastries, that comes back at you. So,
well,
but, yeah,
I got to say,
we're
ordering groceries about once or twice a week and kind of looking to find those staples that last a long time, things we can use in a variety of ways. So what do you suggest? What are the most important pantry staples that people can use in a variety of ways?
Yeah, sure. I'd say as far as starting with like your fresh produce, I would definitely go out with the potatoes, onions, carrots, celery, bell peppers are nice to have. I do a lot of cooking with what we call Trinity, which is peppers, onions, and celery. It gives a lot of flavor to foods. It's nice to have, if you buy like fresh parsley, it's something you can keep fresh for a little while, but then chop it up and dry it out and use it, as a dried herb instead. Other things like produce-wise, things like parsnips, this time of the year, you're going to see, stuff start coming around for the springtime. You can buy things like ramps and asparagus and do a lot of things with those. Other staples to have also is things like canned chicken stock or canned chicken broth or beef broth. If you have an opportunity to make stock at home, something simple like that, it's nice to make that and to freeze that so you have that for later on uses is a good staple. You can roast peppers and freeze them for down the road also if you want to extend the shelf life on some of your produce. Certain produce things do freeze well. Certain things don't freeze well, So canning things is a great way. That's one thing we do a lot of at the restaurants is canned stuff, pickling things, extending the shelf life and things like that. We make homemade kimchi, something we can kind of keep on hand, So there's a lot of things you can do preserving-wise also that, extends the shelf life and all that stuff.
Great. We have Chris on the line. Chris is from Adams, who has a question about food and health. Hi,
sure.
Chris.
Hi, good morning. Actually, I don't have a question, I have a comment. I have two autoimmune diseases, and they happen. This is my luck in life. I have two autoimmune diseases that Western medicine cannot do anything for. And so I have had to ferret out ways to get vertical because otherwise I'm not. And one of the ways I've done that is to go on an anti-inflammatory diet. Now, it just so happens that this particular virus loves people that eat badly. And so
yep.
people are going into the grocery store and they're garbaging up on all kinds of emotional food, things from their childhood,
yep.
Garbage food, and they're eating
yep.
horribly. And the
yep.
advice you have given I do have a question for you. The advice you have given to people is absolutely right. You have to get your immune system in balance, and that doesn't mean taking lots of vitamin C exclusively, but it does mean getting yourself as healthy as possible, and it means excluding a lot of things from your diet that are just making you acidic and ill able to handle this. If you get it, you're going to get sicker. And so the advice you're giving people, which is to eat a lot of fermented foods and to exclude certain things from your diet, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yep. Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Chris. Awesome. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chef, one of the things I saw online, a friend of mine is having these chopped parties with her family. They're all stuck at home, right? So they gather a bunch of stuff they have on hand. You know, you're saying about the things that you should keep on hand. She grabs all this stuff, and then every family member makes something with it. So one day it was appetizers. Sure. The next time it was main meals. And then they posted photos on Facebook of the finished product and had friends vote for the best presentation.
That's
awesome. I thought that was so very cool. But you know what can you give for advice for cooking adventurously and pragmatically when you've got all this stuff? You know, sometimes my cupboard is full and I stare at it and I have no idea what to do with it all.
Yeah, you have to kind of think like flavor wise, like there's like sauce, you know, things like we'll get into some other recipes later on, but things like a mayonnaise, you know, mayonnaise is something that you can easily take and transform it into probably easily 15 different kind of flavorful things. And that you have in your pantry already, from, I don't know, some simple as ketchup to hot sauces to dried, you know, you can make a tzatziki sauce maybe if you wanted to. I think it's thinking outside of the box. You know, maybe you make a tomato sauce like you normally do, but maybe you make it more Indian flair because you have some curry powder that you haven't used in a while. And so I think taking some of that stuff, and some of it works, some of it doesn't work. You know, you
right.
can. I do a lot of roasting of vegetables at home, for my family and for us, and that kind of at the restaurant also. And so I'll take a lot of spices and oils and different, you know, I mean, coconut oil, extra virgin olive oil, different kind of healthier kind of oils, and I'll toss my vegetables in that, and I'll season it with, I mean, all kinds of different stuff. Like I said, from, you know, Italian seasoning mixes to maybe it's a mix you made yourself, because you know, a lot of the fun at home and having seasonings and stuff is you can take, you know, the chili powder you have at home, the cumin, maybe you have some, obviously you have salt, you have pepper, you can make your own like Southwestern Mexican style seasoning if you wanted to, you know? So I think it's just kind of not thinking about what you have, but what you could possibly do with those things.
One other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, there's two people in our house, and I know a lot of people are alone or they just have one other person in their house. We're often looking to make larger meals and then freeze the leftovers, but I know some things freeze better than others. So what are some things that freeze well that we can make?
Definitely. As far as that goes, I would say most soups freeze pretty well. I'll make a lot of soups and break them down into smaller portionings and freeze those. I've even, you know, frozen like chicken stock into like ice cube trays and pop those out, so you actually have smaller portions of that, so you're not having to deal with a big container of chicken broth. I've made different proteins, like cooked meatballs. I've made before. I've done different smoked and roasted pulled pork, and you know, got that all made up and, you know, froze that before. I've done homemade lasagna dinners, you know, pre-portioned, ready to go into the oven for my family. I've made Asian style stuff. I've done like spring rolls and egg rolls. Those freeze really well. So it's a lot of things that definitely can carry over, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We have to take a break in a second here, but you mentioned soups. Cream soups, are they a no-no for freezing? You should not freeze cream soups?
I've actually frozen cream soups. It's not as great as having it fresh and not freezing it, for sure. You know, it's, every time you freeze something, you're basically kind of injecting moisture and water into whatever you're freezing. So that definitely messes with the cream. It makes it a little bit looser kind of consistency. So I'd be a little more careful for the cream soups, but you can definitely freeze those as well.
Okay, great to know. Chef C, our guest today in the final program of our four-part series on the COVID-19 outbreak and the impact on our region. When we return, we'll share some easy condiment recipes to jazz up your next meal and ways to enjoy kitchen time together as a family. Join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email questions and thoughts to Route 51 at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Chef C is here today as we continue our pandemic cooking school with tips and tricks to amp up your kitchen routine. We'd like to hear from you, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Chef, I'd like to incorporate locally sourced ingredients whenever I can. It's hard to do right now, though. But what are some ways that we could maybe connect with those local suppliers and growers and give them some support?
Sure. Well, definitely. The local farmers are totally awesome. They're getting better every year. There's a programs out there you can definitely tap tune into that. We've been on your show before and talked about some of the stuff, but CSA programs in the area are awesome way to get food delivered right to your doorstep. It's pretty much almost as far as that goes. It's springtime, so a lot of things are starting to kind of pop up and kind of sprout. We do have some of the local winter farmers markets that are still kind of hanging on before the season really kicks in. You'll find different kinds of meats and sausages available out there. Some of your local farmers that you can tap into. I'll find a lot of things like microgreens. We have Tony Whitefeather from Whitefeather Farms does a great job in town here. Does a lot of local microgreens and things like that. I deal with farmers who are raising different animals, whether it's pigs, goats. You can buy pieces or parts of cows, if that's what you like, so it's out there. I think you just have to kind of reach out and see what's what. You're going to start to see asparagus being available for some local people as well. If you get a chance to get out there and if you're knowledgeable enough, there's little ramps and things like that are starting to kind of pop up in the areas around us. At Father Fats, we have a garden. We actually started getting some chives already growing in our garden. Things like fresh thyme, so it's going to start popping here once the temperatures kind of jump up a little bit. You're going to see a lot of things starting to happen.
Yeah, I know. We just got that snow earlier this week. It kind of feels like the growing season is never going to get here. But I'm looking outside right now and I can see just a little bit of rhubarb growing in my yard already.
I'm
thinking of planting a raised bed of vegetables and herbs this year for the first time. I've never done that before, but awesome. I have some limited space. So what are some of the most useful things to plant for use in the kitchen? What do you suggest?
As far as your basic stuff, and I like doing basil. Basil is one of those things, as far as the herbs go, that you can kind of cut and use, and it kind of grows and kind of keeps kind of resupplying itself a little bit as it kind of grows. Fresh thyme is a great one that kind of spreads pretty good and grows like crazy. You can do, fresh thyme and tons of stuff. Parsley is a good herb to do. Rosemary is something that you get a lot out of. Different vegetables and things like that you get the most out of. I mean, tomatoes take a little bit of time, but you get a lot out of that as far as once it gets going. Beans are kind of fun to use. It's hard to do things like, potatoes and carrots, depending if you have enough room to grow that in the ground, kind of thing, as far as the spreading goes.
Yeah.
I like doing lettuces, things like Swiss chard. We'll do a lot of Swiss chard and kale at the Father Fats garden.
Yeah.
And that actually is nice because once again, you kind of cut it back and it kind of grows and kind of fills in again, so you get a lot of usage out of that. And kale and Swiss chard is one of those things that you can make. I've made pestos and things like that with kale. You can dry it and make it crispy, so it's got a lot of uses.
So what's a ramp? What is a ramp? What does it look like?
Ramp is a cross between like a green onion and a leek. It's got a flat leaf on it. Kind of has a kind of bulb, almost like a green onion, a little bit smaller, but it's in the onion family. But it's a very short window that they're kind of available in the area in the springtime, basically.
Does it taste like an onion?
It tastes like an onion, yep. Kind of tastes like almost like a shallot or a green onion, depending on what you call them. Yep. We use a lot of green onions and leeks in the restaurant, so it's very much in that flavor profile.
Okay. Well, we get a lot of rhubarb, and I see a lot of that in the spring in the farmers markets, too. I never have any idea what to do with it, though, other than making a rhubarb pie.
Rhubarb is awesome.
rhubarb, what can I do with it?
We do a lot of preserves that we make in the restaurant. We do a lot of cheese boards and things like that. So we'll make a rhubarb that goes with many things like rhubarb strawberry, rhubarb apple, any kind of berry, and rhubarb goes well together. We'll do, pickled rhubarb and drinks sometimes. We'll do, rhubarb pies or empanadas, we'll make different fillings. You just have to kind of balance out the flavor of the, what rhubarb is, and there's different sweeteners you can use for that. And so being a cook and getting in the kitchen is also about tasting things, and it's finding what kind of goes with what. And you have to try things at all different phases. You have to try a piece of raw rhubarb to see what that tastes like, so that your tongue and your senses kind of understand what's going on there. And from there, maybe taste a piece of cooked rhubarb, and from there you start adding things to it and start playing with it and adding vinegars and, having fun. And some of it doesn't work out, but some of it does work out, that's,
sure.
That's the funness of doing that, is you're also educating your cooking senses. You're educating your palate to different things like sweet and sour, and how to balance that, in those flavors.
So you shared with us some condiment recipes. These are pretty great. We've got them on our page, by the way, WPR.com/Route 51. I have to think there for a second. One is this olive tapenade, and this looks so good to me because I'm a salty olive person. Yep. So take us through that a little bit.
Sure. Well, for me, once again, cooking at home, and some of the challenges at home is making sauce and making condiments that kind of go along with your, whether it's a sandwich you're making, whether it's a piece of fish or anything really, so I try to kind of put out there, recipes and stuff that you can tweak and then add things and adjust things to your flavor profile. So this olive peppercini tapenade recipe is an olive tapenade is a basic condiment that normally is made with anchovies and olives and fresh herbs and things like olive oil. So it's great because you can, add a little bit of it, put it into your salad and make a great vinaigrette from it. Next thing you have an olive vinaigrette. If you add a little more oil to it, you can use different kinds of olives. If you like black olives or Kalamata olives or green olives or all those olives, you can make it spicy, not spicy. So for me, it's about, when I look at recipes, I look at ingredients, not necessarily amounts, and I look for, to see what other chefs and cooks are doing out there and what kind of flavor profiles that, they're doing. And then I kind of add my own little twist to that. There's another, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I saw it, some people might be afraid of the anchovies in it. That you said that's optional. You don't have to use that. What does the anchovy
do? Anchovies definitely a thing that it's got a strong taste to it, so you can obviously adjust the anchovy flavors, if you want to do that, or you can just totally leave it out. I personally don't care for too much anchovy flavor because quick side story. One time I ordered a large pepperoni and cheese pizza. I'm from New York, and I love pepperoni and cheese pizza. And I got to my house, and I opened it up, and it's pepperoni and anchovies. And that's something you can't really pick off the pizza necessarily and get the flavor off of there, So that's just a little side story. But, once again, you can still taste really awesome and be a tapenade just because it doesn't have, anchovies in it. It's not going to make the food police aren't going to show up to your house knocking on the door,
So this has the pitted olives, the anchovies, if you want it, the peppercini peppers, parsley, garlic, lemon juice, pepper, olive oil. And you were saying, too, that you can put this on eggs. What else can you put it on? I can imagine it on scrambled eggs would be fantastic.
Exactly. Eggs would be awesome. If you want to put that as a spread on any kind of multiple sandwiches that you might be making, instead of using like mayo or mustard or things like that, put some tapenade on there.
We'll just spread it in a mushroom.
Exactly. But we'll use a little bit of this, put a dollop of that on top of a soup. If you go to eat a soup, maybe you can throw a little dollop of that on top of a soup and make it, if you have maybe a vegetable minestrone soup and you're making that and you want to kind of zest it up a little bit, you can add that in there. You can use it, into, once again, talking about aiolis and mayos, you can take some of that, and next thing you have a tapenade aioli, so you get some creaminess in there that you don't get if it's just a regular tapenade.
Yeah, another recipe that you shared with us that's on our website is Dijon herb aioli. That looks great, too. Yep. Tell us about that.
Yep. Sure, aioli is one of those things that we talked about what to get involved in if you start to get into a kitchen and cook. Aioli is one of those very basic sauces that everybody should kind of know how to make. And it's aioli basically is a fancy word for, mayonnaise, basically. It's an emulsion. An emulsion is also made when you make like a hollandaise sauce. But an aioli is very simple. Usually you start off with a couple of eggs, some lemon juice, a little bit of garlic, some Dijon mustard. And we kind of buzz that all up in the either a food processor, if you have something like that, or a Vitamixer or blender. We do it by hand sometimes. So as we're mixing our eggs with this mixture, we slowly add in our oil. And as we're adding our oil, it's going to get thicker and thicker as we're kind of going, not adding too much at a time. What happens, you basically make an emulsion. If you add the oil too fast, what's going to happen is that you're going to find little bubbles and it's going to be very loose. That means your emulsion has broken and you have to start over, basically. So there's this funness of going through all that stuff and being, you know, being a cook and being a chef. But once you know, you know, once you master this aioli, so now you take that and you can add tons of things to it. In this particular case, we're taking Dijon mustard. You could take a brown mustard. You could take a Creole mustard. You can take no mustard. If you want to do just fresh herbs or dried herbs, you can add some, you know, some lemon juice in there and, you know, make it kind of like a nice light spread that you can use on sandwiches. You can take that if you're making like chicken salad, instead of making your traditional just basic mayonnaise in your chicken salad, you can take this Dijon herb aioli, mix that with your chicken salad. Sometimes we'll take aiolis and we'll cook chicken breast or fish and we'll sear the chicken breast or fish first and flip it over, then smear some of this aioli on there and throw some crust on top of that and throw that in the oven. Next thing you know, you have a nice kind of crusty, kind of bubbly, yummy fish and chicken.
I can imagine this even with something like French fries too.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah,
definitely. Any kind of aioli or mayo like that that you use for, you know, French fries or dipping, that's once again the way you can kind of take that.
Yeah, chicken strips, potato chips, that kind of thing. That would be delicious.
Yep.
Another sauce that you shared with us is the tzatziki sauce.
Sure.
Take us through that. That looks like it would be fantastic with a gyro or kind of pita sandwiches.
Sure. Tzatziki is a fun sauce. Once again, it's kind of, you know, most of us have sour cream normally that we use, but having something like a Greek yogurt that's kind of got a little more of a zing, a little more of a zest, a little more of those kind of food things that you kind of want going on in your body and, you know, what you eat. You know, it's a good way to kind of build from there. So what we do is we take a Greek yogurt, we have some fresh cucumber, some extra virgin olive oil. In this case, we're using a little bit of lemon juice and dill and some fresh garlic. And to kind of twist it up a little bit, we're adding some sriracha sauce. If you kind of want to go the kind of spicy route, if you want to take it deeper than that, you can throw something like ginger in there, some fresh ginger or ginger powder. You can put sesame oil in there. You can put some cilantro, some lime juice. You know, so there's a lot of ways you can take that tzatziki, you know, sauce and make it some other things. I mean, it's traditional tzatziki is a Greek sauce, you know, usually served with pitas and things like that. But there's nothing wrong with taking that and kind of adding your own little flair to it and still using it, you know, on your pita and still using it, you know, we do falafel at the restaurant. So we're, you know, a lot of times we're looking for sauces to put with our falafel, you know, French fries. We do roasted chicken wings that we also use tzatziki sauce in as far as the dipping sauce goes with that.
A couple of these recipes call for either lemon or lime juice. Is it important to use fresh or can you use the bottled juices?
Bottles, if that's all you have, that's fine. Fresh is always better. Fresh is nice because you can also take that fresh citrus that you have and use what they call the zest on the outside of the citrus. It gives a little more flavor into a dish you're making. So they actually have like these hand zesters that you buy. And it kind of basically kind of shaves little pieces of the outside zest of the citrus, puts that it, you know, there's a lot of oils in that zest. There's lots of oils and stuff like that. So if you kind of put that into your food, you're going to get a little more of a flavor from the citrus that you get, not just from the juice.
So can you use a regular grater for that, or do you need something that's a little more fine?
You can. You just want to be careful. There's a few parts to citrus. There's the zest on the outside. There's the pith, which is the white part after you get to the zest. And then there's the actual, you know, the fruit itself. The problem with the pith and the white part is that it's very bitter. So you just want to be careful if you are going to grate it with a bigger grater that you don't get too much of that white part into the zest.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Can we talk about leftovers? I know a lot of people are still using up their ham leftovers. We are too, from Easter. So what are some creative ways to use meats in multiple dishes, or not even meats, but I mean, what can we do with leftovers?
Anything. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like the leftover king. A lot of times, you know, obviously we have all of us pretty much have leftovers on a daily basis, you know? So one of the things about being home and, not just looking at it as leftovers, is that you have to look at it as a new dish. You know, so I'll take, you know, example, something easy is maybe you made hamburgers or brats or hot dogs, you know, hamburgers or brats the night before on the grill, and you have those leftovers for the next day. So instead of just eating in the normal way that you normally eat them, how about using that in a soup maybe and making, you know, like a bratwurst potato soup? How about, you know, taking, you know, those hamburgers and breaking them up and chopping them up and making yourself some nachos that you could, you know, whip up really fast and easy. Quesadillas are one of those quick things that I'm constantly making at home. That's a really quick snack to have. Different sauces, you know, can obviously you can take your sauces and transform those into different things like we've been kind of talking about. You know, vegetables, I'll do a lot of stir fries at home actually. So, you know, I almost always have rice in my pantry. It's good to have rice in your pantry. It's one of those good staples to have. And I'll do a lot of different kinds of stir fries. I'll take any of those proteins or just vegetables that I have and just a quick stir fry with some soy sauce. You know, if you're looking for different ingredients to have in your pantry also, soy sauce, sesame oil are definitely two things I would have. Some kind of sweet chili sauce or like a rice wine vinegar is good to have. You know, I probably use those four things on a pretty easy basis, you know, when I make my stir fries. Once again, it gives it flavor, so you're not just sauteing just vegetables and rice together, and oh, it's not too exciting, you know, but if you add, you know, a little bit of sweet chili to it and some sriracha and things like that, kind of spices it up a little bit without being too spicy, just flavorful.
What are, you know, I hear these ideas from you and I think all of these things I want to make now over the next couple of days, but on a daily basis, it's sometimes hard to find that inspiration. Do you have any favorite cooking apps that you would recommend that are great resources to find some of this inspiration?
It's changed so much in the past, you know, back when I started cooking, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's so awesome now because you can literally go on to different sites. You know, there's actually a lot of people that are doing quarantine cooking sites, and then people are, you know, posting different things that they're making and doing and getting ideas. And I do Epicurious, Food and Wine. You know, I kind of follow different chefs, you know, across the country, across the world, as far as what they might be doing. For me, I just, you know, I get inspiration from different flavors and from different regions and different parts of the country and of the world, you know, so it's, I'm always looking to challenge myself and kind of do something new and different, you know?
Right. There are so many apps out there. We use Yumly a lot, and it's great because you can plug in the things that you have in your kitchen, and it will come up with a list of things.
Good
that,
ideas.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's very cool. So, and I want to remind listeners too, that those recipes we talked about are on our website, wpr.org/route51. We do need to take a break. You're listening to Chef C in our pandemic cooking school. This is the fourth and final program in our series on the impact of COVID-19 in our region. When we return, we'll talk about some simple go-to foods for easy snacking throughout the day, tips for baking bread, and other delicious treats as well. We'd love to hear from you. Call us at 800-780-9742 or email questions to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Chef Christian Shirwanka, best known as Chef C, is here today with a pandemic cooking school, tips to make the most of your time in the kitchen as the governor's safer at home order continues. Your questions are welcome too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or call us at 800-780-9742. Chef, I am a snacker. I know there are plenty of parents listening who need some easy-to-go foods for hungry kids throughout the day. So there are other snackers out there. So what are some easy things we can make to keep on hand?
I live on snacking probably. So as a chef, I'm constantly just tasting things and eating things, and I find it actually hard to sit down and eat a complete meal, to tell you the truth. So easy things to make for your kids and things like that. Obviously, fresh fruits and fresh produce is crucial and key, especially at an early age. One of the funnest things I do as a chef is I go to some of the preschool and pre-K kids, and we have show and tell classes, and we actually eat and try different fruits and vegetables. You know, it's crucial when they're young because they don't know too much yet as far as food goes, you know, and kind of get it into their system and have them try different things and sour things and sweet things, and unfortunately, we're kind of brought up in the society of everything being sweet, sweet, sweet. You know, so we're constantly looking for sweetness in our foods. So it's nice to do things like fresh carrots, you know, fresh cauliflower, any kind of fresh vegetable, tarot tooth, broccoli. We have tons of, you know, local vegetables, obviously, that grow in Wisconsin and all in our different areas that we can tap into, whether it's kohlrabi and things like that. You know, if you can do the whole dairy thing, you know, fresh cheese, little cubes of cheese is kind of nice as far as that goes. You know, fresh cooked, if you have chicken breast that you cook ahead of time or things like that, you can kind of serve cold and kind of chopped up in little cubes, if the, you know, making kind of fun for the kids, you know, for cooking for kids and with kids is a lot of cooking, and what we do is also visual, you know, so a lot of kids see things first. We all see things before we eat things, so right away, you know, in your mind you have an idea of what this is going to be all about, good or bad, you know. So
right.
I think it's important to have fun with our kids, and when we're trying to feed our kids and do different things like that, smoothies actually is a great way. My kids aren't huge breakfast eaters, you know, so what I'll do is I'll use Greek yogurt, and I'll take like frozen berries, even if I have frozen berries, and apples and bananas, and I'll sneak things. They don't know this, but I'll put like kale and things like that into there, you know, and get them to eat things that they wouldn't normally eat, you know, but it gets them, you know, everybody loves a smoothie. Smoothies are fun, you know, and it almost looks like a shake. You know, so you kind of make it fun like that, and you can make it different colors depending on what kind of different vegetables you use, and the kids can actually get in there and make it themselves and have fun with it, you know. So it's doing things like that, I think, is important, you know.
Well, and you know, speaking of kids, how can you involve them in the kitchen? What are some ways to get them involved in the cooking process? What kind
For
of
sure.
jobs can you
For
give
sure.
them?
For sure. It kind of goes back to, you know, we talked about, you know, knife skills and getting them comfortable in the kitchen with, you know, sharp knives and understanding, like, it is a dangerous situation, you know, and, you know, right off the bat, you need to explain to your kids and make them understand anytime they're in the kitchen around the stove, whether it's gas, electric, knives, there's always a chance that you could possibly get hurt. You know, something that I stress to my cooks on a daily basis to this day, you know, because you lose track of, you know, your time and what you're doing, and next thing you know, you get cut or burnt. So I think getting them comfortable in the kitchen with knives, you know, chopping things, doing some of that basic work, you know, getting themselves comfortable with the stove, even in the oven, you know, have them, you know, put stuff in the oven, pull stuff out of the oven in a very careful, safe way, knowing your surroundings and what they're doing. Same thing on the stovetop. If they're stirring things, maybe you're helping you do things like that, you know, getting them comfortable with being around the flame or not a flame, and understanding that the hot parts and that, you know, you don't touch this and you don't do that, you know. And then I think as they get more comfortable with those things, you're going to find that you're going to kind of come into the kitchen a lot easier with you and kind of do some of that stuff with you. And it's, you know, pastries and baking and cookies and fun things like that as a way to get them into the, you know, the process. I have a 14-year-old that isn't a, pretty much into cooking and likes doing that stuff. And, you know, she's made, this past week alone, she's made, you know, fresh biscuits a couple of times, pancakes, cookies, you know, so stuff like that, that they can do that. It also doesn't involve working on a stove or a hot oven. They can mix things and, you know, learn how to use a mixer and whisk things and have fun with those, all those different fun utensils.
Yeah, I think my first job in the kitchen as a child that I can remember was using one of those hand beaters to to beat eggs when my mom was cooking. So I mean, that is a great way to introduce people to that. But, you know, you were talking about baking, and I have to say, all over social media, I'm seeing everyone's baking, quarantine bread photos everywhere. My experience baking bread has just been a disaster. I'm not good at it. So what are some of the most important things to know, basic things to know about baking bread?
Bread's fun, you know, and it's like you're saying, some people have that niche and some people don't. It comes easier to others, but it's, you know, it's all about getting there and trying it. You know, I think with breads, it's about understanding the different kind of breads that you can possibly make. You know, example is, okay, like a pizza dough. You know, there's basic pizza doughs, but there's also pizza dough that you can add some different things to it, make it into variations. There's focaccia dough. You know, focaccia is a very basic kind of dough you can make. Understanding yeast, you know, I think a lot of people kind of get scared of yeast and things like that as far as how to use yeast. And, you know, yeast
helps
the whole process.
What's the difference between the yeast? There's the active dry yeast. There's instant yeast. What's the difference there?
Usually the instant instant yeast is something that is kind of already kind of ready to go, and it's going to, you know, do its job right away. Whereas if you have like a dry yeast, what you do is you have to kind of activate that. And what they do there is yeast needs kind of sugar, and it kind of needs moisture to kind of to live and kind of grow and survive. So what you do with a dry yeast is you basically take warm water, you take a little bit of sugar, and you kind of mix those together. And about, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes later, you get this kind of bloom of yeast. And from there, you kind of go and kind of go about your business. Sourdoughs and things like that, you'll see a lot of people doing like starters. A starter is kind of almost like you're taking like a culture, and every time you go to make bread, you're kind of starting off with this, what they call a starter. And the starter basically is, you know, is when they get kind of flour and kind of water and kind of make like a kind of fermentation that kind of goes on, and they kind of feed it on a weekly, daily, yearly basis. So a lot of starters you'll see are, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years old that they kind of use. And it's those starters that give, you know, like a really good sourdough flavor into your bread. You know, when you make different breads, you're going to try to infuse flavor into those breads, and there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, they're using dried herbs, they're using fresh herbs. You know, if you're making something like a focaccia, you know, which is kind of fun, you can use things like roasted tomatoes and olives, like you said you like a lot, and you can throw some meats on there and different things, you know. So
the sourdough starter thing sounds pretty cool. So how would I get started with that? How do you make one?
There's a lot of sites you can actually probably go to that kind of give you a better idea of, you know, the process of that. And, you know, there's different flours that you can use, you know, so I would kind of reach out to some of that and kind of get a little more of a background of what they do.
Okay. All right. I mean, it sounds weird though, that you have this sourdough thing for 10 or 15
kind of
years.
Yeah. Just kind of sitting out. And this really, breads are kind of like a living kind of growing thing, you know, and it's, you know, some people, you know, will just use like a natural yeast process, and they'll kind of, let the natural fermentation kind of happen over a couple day period, or you can kind of go like the quick yeast way, you know. So it really depends on, you know, are you using whole wheat flour, or are you using, you know, there's different all kinds of flours out there. You know, there's, you know, if you're gluten free, there's, you know, rice flours and things like that you can use, and there's mixtures of different flours you can use for gluten free breads, and that's a whole different spectrum, you know.
All right. Are you big on grilling? I would imagine with your restaurants you probably are, yes?
Definitely. We do tons of grilling. You know, grilling's an awesome way to obviously add flavor to whether it's fish or meats or even vegetables. A lot of times when I'm grilling, I'll marinate or brine different things that I'm using. If I'm grilling like meats and things like that, a lot of times I'll take my steaks and my chops and, you know, ribs and things like that, and I'll put them into a brine. And the brine kind of basically kind of injects flavor and kind of moisture into that meat that you're going to kind of be kind of grilling later on. If I'm doing like things like vegetables or fish, a lot of times I'll do like a light marinade on that, where I'll use olive oil, fresh herbs and garlic, and even like balsamic vinegar, and kind of toss that stuff all together and let that sit for at least a couple hours before you grill it, because what that's going to do is it's going to kind of be absorbed into the meat or into the vegetables that you're working with, or fish, whatever it is. And that's going to kind of just make it taste more flavorful when you go to grill it.
So the best kind of marinade, should you buy something, or is there something easy that you can make for a marinade?
I just like making stuff at home, to tell you the truth. I usually use some kind of oil. You can use an olive oil or vegetable oil. I like throwing some soy sauce in there. So having that soy sauce on hand is good. Worcestershire sauce is another good one to use. Worcestershire is a good sauce that's kind of got a lot of what they call umami flavors. So it kind of gives you that earthy kind of flavor in the background. Fresh herbs, dried herbs, things like rosemary, parsley, fresh garlic is great to have on hand for stuff like this. Green onions I'll chop up in there. I'll use citrus sometimes. I'll take orange, lemons, limes, and I'll make thin slices of those and kind of put that in there. I'll take sesame oil if I want to kind of put like an Asian flair on there. I'll take a marinade and I'll do like sesame oil with even some sriracha. Sometimes I'll get some sambal, which is like a dried chili paste that they use sometimes, curry pastes, curry powders. You know, so there's a lot of direction you can kind of go, kind of like we were talking earlier, just about using those different flavors you have in your pantry and, you know, put those into your marinade, you know.
So smokers are big right now too, and I know, well, weather is warming up, we hope. So people are bringing out those grills, they're bringing out the smokers. And sometimes those smokers, I think probably can give you an opportunity to smoke meats that you can use in a bunch of different dishes. They might last a little bit longer than, So what are some of the best meats to smoke?
Yeah, we have different meats to smoke. Obviously ribs, any kind of pork or beef rib would be awesome to smoke. I'll do a lot of roasts. I'll take, beef chuck roasts. I'll take pork butts, things like that, shoulder meats. So what I'll do is I'll put a dry rub on those before I smoke them, you know. So I'll say if I'm doing like a Southwestern style roasted pork, I'll take my Southwestern seasoning and salt and pepper and kind of rub that all over the pork roast that I have. And that's it, even 24 hours is nice. And the next day I'll throw that in the smoker, and depending on your smoker, there's a lot of different smokers out there, from gas to electric. I use mainly charcoal in the smokers that we use, so I like the charcoal flavor that you kind of get. Wood chips, there's tons of different kinds of wood chips you can get, from hickory, apple, mesquite. There's different sizes of wood chips. There's more of log style kind of chunks of wood that you can use. We actually work, we have a nice relationship with an Amherst Central Waters Brewery, and we actually get some of their bourbon barrels that they use, and we actually chop those up and actually use those in our smoker, so we get like a nice kind of bourbon barrel smoke in there, which is amazing.
That sounds terrific.
Yeah,
what about fish? Salmon is a is a
salmon's
big thing.
Salmon's a great way to smoke. We'll smoke shrimp. We'll smoke scallops. Any kind of fish pretty much any kind of fish we serve in the restaurants. If you're looking for, like a different way to serve tuna, you can, throw some smoke on tuna and make a tuna salad with your smoked tuna instead of doing just your basic tuna salad, if that's something that you like. You can take, smoke like your perch or smoke your walleye. A lot of people make different dips and things like that and spreads. You can, put a little smoke on that fish and give it a little different taste as well on that.
Should you, put some kind of rub on that beforehand, or do you just slap it in there?
Still some kind of seasoning. Yeah, the same, just like we talked about with my fish. Even if it's a thin fillet piece of fish, whatever it is, I'll still put some seasoning on there to kind of get something on there. That's just going to be absorbed into the fish. It's important to watch your heat when you're smoking fish. That's a little side note there, is that, fish obviously are more delicate. So it's going to take less smoking time in your smoker if you're doing fish or seafood. So I would definitely watch that, depending on what kind of smoker you have, is to, keep a close eye. Don't have too many beers and leave that alone. You're going to come back and it's going to be not much left probably. So just be cautious of that when you're smoking seafoods.
Okay. Our producer, executive producer Rick, has a question. He has a family argument he wants you to settle for him. Do you soak or not soak wood chips? What's the word on that?
I want to say I soak my wood chips. Something that what that does is that extends the smoking process. Okay, so that if you just think about it, the wood chips and the wood aren't going to burn as fast and smoke out as quickly if that wood is kind of damp and moist, basically, is a good way to look at it.
I think that Rick lost the family argument from the look on his face. That appears to
Sorry,
be
Rick.
The case.
I mean, I don't soak any of my wood chips at all. I use always dry wood chips. Just kidding.
All right, good to know. I want to thank you so much. This has just been great. That is all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Again, a big thanks to our guest, Chef Christian Chiwanka. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Our producer is Joy Ratch Kramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program and all four programs in our COVID-19 series at WPR.org/Route 51. The recipes we talked about today will also be on the website. Next week, we'll host a discussion on officer-involved shootings and other critical incidents with a look at how police and prosecutors define reasonable force. Until then, we're heading out of town.